So I just flew in from Yosemite, and boy, are my arms tired. They say to start a speech with a joke, but it's probably not worth it if that's the joke. Actually, I didn't even fly in from Yosemite. I drove, and it's not my arms that are tired, it's my feet. Jim and I, my husband Jim and I, and two friends of ours drove up together to Yosemite last Sunday while you were here worshiping with Everett Howe, and I hope you enjoyed him. We were driving up the 405 to the 14 to the 395 through Palmdale, Lancaster, and Mojave. We stopped at Lone Pine for lunch, then kept going up the east side of California, Mount Whitney to our left, and Death Valley and the ancient Bristlecone Pines to our right. By Sunday afternoon, we reached Mono Lake and the city that's called Lee Vining, and then turned left into the national park from the east along Highway 120 called Tioga Road. We drove through the park to the west edge where we were staying. We had rented a house in a little community that's inside the park borders called Foresta, and we were able to sit on our porch and look east into the valley with views of El Capitan and Half Dome. Monday, we got up early and we drove back up the Tioga Road to Tuolumne Meadows. We hiked beneath Cathedral Peak to Cathedral Lakes, ate sandwiches from our backpacks, hiked around the lakes, and then back, a round trip of 13 miles. Tuesday, we started again from Tuolumne Meadows, but hiked the opposite direction, north instead of south. Our destination that day was a series of impressive waterfalls near a camp called Glen Aulin. Round trip that day was 14 miles. Jim and I like to hike, but we only do day hikes. I don't like to carry any more on my back than water and sunblock and a snack. And I like to come home every evening to a real shower and a real bed. So I'm not a backpacker or a tent camper. Wednesday, July 4th, was our only day in Yosemite Valley, which is the area that most people think of when they think of Yosemite. We parked our car at the Awani Hotel, which is now called the Majestic Yosemite Hotel. The hotel had to change its name a couple of years ago from a legal dispute. From the valley floor, we rode a tour bus up to the south rim of the canyon to a spot called Glacier Point. And then from Glacier Point, we hiked down the Panorama Trail, which goes counterclockwise around the east end of the valley. So from the trail, we looked across the valley at Yosemite Falls, Nevada Falls, Vernal Falls, El Capitan, Half Dome, and oh my God, was it amazing. One of the most thrilling hiking days I have ever had. 13 miles, mostly downhill, but even so. And boy, were my feet tired. Thursday morning, we did a short 3-mile hike to the Merced Grove of Giant Sequoias, and then we drove back, got back in the car, and drove home. A really fantastic trip, a real vacation. From Glacier Point on the Panorama Trail hike on Wednesday, I got my first really good look at Mount Star King. Mount Star King is a mountain in Yosemite National Park. It's a little higher than Half Dome and a little to the south of Half Dome, and it's named for a Unitarian Universalist minister, Thomas Star King. Thomas Star King was born in New York City in 1824. He was the eldest of 6 children. His father was a minister for a Universalist church in Charleston, Massachusetts, which is just across the Charles River from Boston, and Star King imagined the same career for himself. His father died when Star King was 15. As the eldest child, Star became the breadwinner. He got a job in the Charleston Naval Yards, had no time for school, but he studied for the ministry on his own. At age 21, the congregation at his father's old church called him as their minister. But after a few years, Star realized they would always see him as a child. So he sought a new church where he could establish his own reputation. Theodore Parker, you know him, recommended Star King for a Unitarian church in Boston called the Hollis Street Church. The Hollis Street Church had recently suffered a split over issues of abolition, And they were having trouble calling a minister because of the conflict and because the remnant congregation could no longer afford a full-time salary. Starr King was a Universalist, not a Unitarian, and he had no formal education. So the Hollis Church, Street Church, must have been pretty desperate to call him, but they did. And Starr King served the Hollis Street Church for 11 years, supplementing his part-time income lecturing in cities throughout New England and as far west as St. Louis, Missouri. After 11 years at the Hollis Street Church, Starr King realized that in Boston, in the shadow of Harvard Divinity School, that his Universalist background and his lack of a formal education meant that he would never be fully accepted by the established Reed Snobby Unitarian clergy. His career prospects in New England were limited. So, in 1860, he answered a call from the Unitarian Church in San Francisco, as far from Harvard as you could go. His first sermon at the San Francisco Church was on April 29, 1860. He was an immediate success, recognized for his spirit, his natural intelligence, and his powerful speaking voice. And that summer, Starr King arranged a tour to see California's mountains. Starr King had always been attracted to nature. While he was in New England, Starr King had enjoyed vacations in New Hampshire's White Mountains. He was eager now to have similar experiences in the natural landscape of California. And after he saw what he saw, he wrote sermons for his congregation and letters that he sent to newspapers in Boston where they were published and described his experience for people who couldn't see these natural wonders for themselves. Here is an excerpt from a sermon that Starr King wrote following a trip to Yosemite in the summer of 1860. A fresh impression of the marvels of nature always awakens a religious emotion. I thought of this more seriously than ever before when, about 2 weeks ago, I first looked down from the Mariposa Trail into the tremendous fissure of the Sierras. The place is fitly called Inspiration Point. A vast trench, cloven by omnipotence, amid a tumult of mountains, yawned beneath us. The length of it was 7 or 8 miles. The sides of it were bare rock, and they were perpendicular. All this, no doubt, seems tame enough in the wording, and even if a vivid picture of the actual scene could be given here by actual description, some of you might say that it is only a pile of rock overhanging a river course, not very remarkable, and certainly not religiously suggestive. But I do not think that there was one in our party who had the feeling, when that surprising view first broke upon us, that he was looking upon a mere freak of natural forces or a patch of chaos. I am sure we all felt that something more than matter was being shown to us, a clear gleam of the infinite majesty. If the emotion which that first view excited could remain with us, I am sure that all life would be more reverent and loyal. And that is a large portion of the value of such impressive wonders in nature. They break in for a moment, if no more, upon our materialistic and skeptical estimate of the world, and show us that it is penetrated with divine meaning, that it is an expression of infinite power and thought. Yosemite Valley was cloven by a glacier, not by omnipotence, but that makes it no less awesome. Starr King is right that a fresh impression of the marvels of nature always awakens a religious emotion. I felt it myself, standing at that same inspiration point in Yosemite, standing at the foot of the giant sequoias in the Mariposa Grove, in the Merced Grove, standing at the base of waterfalls or at the top, looking across the clear lakes or up to the jagged ridges of Cathedral Peak. I felt the immensity of existence, the privilege of consciousness, the humbleness of the human ego. I felt the peaceful stillness of the stately trees and the solitude of the forest trail. I felt it even in the sting of a mosquito on my neck, or a chubby marmot running across a rock, or a friendly crow that would fly to our porch at the rental house and eat walnuts we set out for him from the porch railing. How far it all is from the troubles of human politics, fear, and anger, and how trivial that seems standing near trees that measure their lives in centuries. How far it seems from work. Now, I love my job, so don't get me wrong. Thank you for this pulpit and this chance to be your minister and for this full-time salary. But we need vacation too, so thank you also for giving me time for vacation. For those of us who are lucky enough to have work that is satisfying and fulfilling, we still need rest. We need retreat. We need Sabbath. We need the reminder that we are not at the center of existence, but at the edge. That there is all this amazing stuff going on. There are trees growing, water falling, mountains rising by volcanoes and plate tectonics and being worn down by glaciers that have nothing to do with invoices and staff meetings and email. Outside work, outside ourselves, we could for a time just stand aside and be instead of do. It's so refreshing, it's so humbling, and it is so necessary. The spectacular views of nature attract us because we know in ourselves that the same forces that created the canyon and the mountains created us also. We are kin, the wonders of nature and us. Our eyes were made to recognize this particular kind of beauty. We see ourselves, and at the same time, our narrow selves are so expanded to encompass the scale of the mountain and the river and the time represented in their creation. It is that expanded feeling that we call spiritual, and that is the religious feeling. A signpost at the trailhead for the Cathedral Lakes Trail that we hiked on Monday has a quote from John Muir. After he made the first recorded ascent of Cathedral Peak in 1869, which he made in a three-piece suit with a vest, he wrote in his journal, "This, I may say, is the first time I have been to church in California." That religious feeling, that feeling that we have been to church in nature is renewed with every visit to nature. But we lose it again so quickly when we return to our regular lives that we must go back regularly. Star King says, "If the emotion which that first view excited could remain with us, I am sure that all life would be more reverent and loyal." Here's another excerpt from another Star King sermon. This one is from 1863, and it's titled Lessons from the Sierra Nevada. He wrote this: "I believe that if, on every Sunday morning, before going to church, we could be lifted to a mountain peak and see a horizon line of 600 miles enfolding the copious splendor of the light on such a varied expanse, or if we could look upon a square mile of flowers representing all the species with which the creative spirit embroiders a zone, or if we could be made to realize the distance of the earth from the sun, or if we could fairly perceive through our outward sense one or two features of the outward order and glory of nature, our materialistic dullness would be broken. Surprise and joy would be awakened. We should feel that we live amid the play of infinite thought, and the devout spirit would be stimulated so potently that our hearts would naturally mount in praise and prayer." I believe he's right. So a little bit more about Star King. He took his first trip to Yosemite in the summer of 1860. So that was just a few months after he arrived in California. That year was an election year, and there were three candidates running for president: Abraham Lincoln, of the Republican Party, Stephen Douglas of the Northern Democrats, and John C. Breckinridge representing the Southern Democrats. California had entered the Union as a free state 10 years earlier in 1850, but California in 1850 and still in 1860 felt very isolated. The Transcontinental Railroad wouldn't open until 1869. In 1860, there wasn't even a telegraph service connecting the East and West coasts of the United States. California was mining impressive amounts of wealth in the gold rush and sending taxes to a federal government that felt very removed from Californian concerns. Democrats controlled every level of California state government, and Starr King worried that the state would vote for one of the Democratic candidates. He campaigned for Abraham Lincoln and a unified country in a series of speeches throughout San Francisco and the small towns of Northern California. So Abraham Lincoln was elected in November 1860. California's 4 electoral votes went to Lincoln, with Starr King given the credit. South Carolina seceded the next month, December 1860. The Confederate States of America were organized in February 1861. Abraham Lincoln was inaugurated in March. In April, shots were fired on Fort Sumter, and the Civil War began. Starr King spent the war years serving the church in San Francisco and also serving the cause of the Union Army. Far away from the war itself, Californians were not recruited to fight, but Starr was contacted by his friend Henry Whitney Bellows, who was organizing a sanitary commission, which was a system of medical care for wounded soldiers. They needed money. Starr King used his speaking throughout the state and into the Pacific Northwest to eventually raise more than $1 million, which was a full quarter of the entire budget for the Sanitary Commission. The work wore him out. Starr King died in 1864. He was recognized as a hero in California and nationally. His wartime efforts had kept California's gold on the side of the Union Army, and his descriptions of the natural beauty of California awakened the consciousness of the nation to the importance of protecting our environment. Yosemite was first legally protected by California in 1864, the year that Starr King died, and that same year they named a mountain for him. The core of healthy spirituality is our quest to realize our personal connection to something larger than ourselves. It's not that we need to invent a connection to some greater thing. It's that we see that we are already, in our essence, the expression of something larger than our narrow individual ego that constantly strives to take priority in our consciousness. When we can lift our spirits beyond and above the small, the narrow, the everyday, we see ourselves as one with the vastness of the universe, the enormity of creation, the rolling eons of time and infinity of space. Then we come into the spiritual perspective of peace, of gratitude, and of love. It is there we are our best. It is from there that we can do our best. It is from there that truth becomes separated from bias, and courage removed from self-preservation, and love becomes selfless. Places like Yosemite force us into that perspective, which is why their preservation and accessibility are so necessary. It's gratifying to see the crowds enjoying themselves in national parks and knowing that they are getting the enlivening and enlightening spiritual perspective that we all need. It's also great to go out on a long hike and get away from the human crowd and just be in the stillness of nature. But you don't need to go to a national park for that spiritual experience of connection to something larger than yourself. You can get it at a city park or at the beach. You can get it sitting on your couch with a book or sitting on a cushion meditating. The place you usually can't get it is at work. because work necessarily focuses on the small and the self. So we all need time away from work, regular Sabbath time built in to every occupation, vacation time, a time and a place to get away. And it's great that in a place like Yosemite, filled with sites calling us to larger connection, there stands a mountain with a name that reminds me of my faith. Our connection to Unitarian Universalist history is another way to recognize our connection to things larger than ourselves. We are New Englanders and Harvard graduates and self-taught elder brothers and small congregations fractured over debates about important issues. We are eloquent speakers and prophets and fundraisers for important causes, and we are the people who hear the speeches and are inspired and who give generously. We are heroes because there have been heroes in our faith who would claim us as we claim them. So it is us too who are named in that mountain, even though we never stand on it, perhaps never even see it. We are attached to it, connected to it, connected as it is to the park and to the planet and to this something, this everything greater than ourselves, which guides us, inspires us, and loves us, calling us to our best and calling us to itself. Thank you.